Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We're a little late. You ready to start? Tonight, we're going to come in contact with Samson, one of the better known Old Testament Bible characters. Anybody who spent any time in Sunday school at all knows about Samson, and all they usually know about him is that he had long hair, kind of a Ted Nugent looking fella, and that he had a girlfriend named Delilah, and that when he cut his hair off, that's how he got caught, and that's pretty much the Sunday school story. Maybe you hear about him at the end of his life knocking over the pillars of the Philistines. Maybe you know about him going to a war with nothing but the jawbone of a donkey. Maybe you know that, but there's actually a lot more going on in the story than just that. So I'd like to give you a few introductory notes, and then we'll get into chapter 13 of the book of Judges, so you can turn there if you haven't already. In many ways, the story of Samson is sort of a microcosm of what the whole book of Judges is about. The book of Judges is about Israel having success and conquering their enemies and then becoming full of themselves and thinking that they're independent, free-thinking folk who can do whatever they want and treat God however they want and approach Him however they want. And then they end up back under bondage as they fall under God's attitude adjustments. The same thing happens in the life of Samson. He starts out so very well. In fact, he is one of the few characters in the Bible whose birth is announced by an angel. This is a very big thing. And you will even see the language, common Old Testament language, that the Spirit of God is upon him, and that's why he has his successes. But when we read about his downfall, as awful as his downfall is, you read nothing of the Spirit of God being on him, and instead you see him being self-willed and egocentric and makes the very, very common mistake that human beings make, which is to start thinking that their successes are somehow theirs. And he's going to put his strength in the notion of his hair, but before we chuckle at him, which we're all sort of tempted to do, I can think of a lot of people who have put their sense of spiritual well-being in similarly silly things. There are lots and lots of people who think that the reason they're having success in life or the reason that they're having spiritual success or blessings is because they themselves either did something or trusted something or rubbed some rabbit's foot somewhere, did something that God said, oh, well, I must respond to that. And that, again, is the theme of Samson. When it's God empowering Samson by his own spirit, Samson has great success. When Samson decides to do it on his own, when he decides that the ability is within himself, God just crushes him. And so let me read you a couple of introductory notes here. And this is from James E. Smith's Old Testament Survey series. I thought as I was reading through different commentaries and notes that his summation of Samson was particularly good, so I'll read that to you. And it also gives us a time frame here. He says, the double oppression of Ammonites and Philistines began about 1126 BC. So 1,100 years before Christ arrives on the planet. After 18 years of misery, Jephthah had been able to deliver the Transjordan area from the Ammonites. That happened around 1108 BC. West of Jordan, however, the oppression continued. Altogether, the Philistines dominated the Israelites for 40 years until about 1085 BC. Thus, the last oppression in the book of Judges is twice as long as the next longest. From this oppression, Judges records no deliverance, but only a bit of periodic relief through the instrumentality of Samson. Samson judged Israel for 20 years during the Philistine oppression. He was not a military leader like Gideon or Jephthah. He used his own strength to inflict devastating blows upon the oppressors. Samson, however, was never able to free the land from the power of the Philistines. That remained for Samuel, a man of prayer, to accomplish. Samuel then takes us to about 1043. Though Samson was extraordinary in many ways, he does not appear to have been a zealous servant of the Lord, nor does the text supply evidence of any close bond between Samson and his countrymen. On the contrary, Samson was very friendly with the Philistines. He seemed particularly attracted to Philistine women. He was a man of impulse who was controlled by sensual desires. Revenge dominated his thinking, even in his prayers. Whereas other judges were raised up in times of crisis to deliver God's people, Samson was dedicated to his task from his birth. Of the 23 references to the angel of Yahweh that are in this book, 13 of them are found in the account of Samson's birth. Samson is the only deliverer in the book of Judges about whose birth anything is related. The birth announcement demonstrated, number one, the painstaking steps that Yahweh took to provide his people with a judge, and two, that deliverance would only come through a special work of God. God's people were so powerless in themselves that they could only receive the gracious deliverance as a gracious gift from Yahweh. The author seems to be placing in juxtaposition two contrasting portraits of Samson. The first is with the Spirit. You see that in chapters 14 and 15. But the second is without the Spirit. By chapter 16, Samson is self-sufficient and out of control. The chapter begins with Samson's head on the pillow of a harlot, and it concludes with his hands on another god's pillars. So again, the story of Samson is a really tragic story. It starts with an angelic announcement of his birth. He's one of the earliest Nazarites that we find anywhere in the Bible, that he's not going to drink any wine or strong drink. He's never going to have a razor on his head. He's not going to cut his hair. So he is dedicated to God from the moment of his birth and has great successes had he simply remained faithful to God. But he broke some cardinal rules right away. Even the wife that he took was a wife of the Philistines, not from among his own people. And God was very, very clear that the Israelites should not intermarry with the people from the surrounding communities. And of course, the reason he did it is the same reason that anybody doesn't follow after God's dictates. God is very clear about how we are to be, how we are to live, what we're to do, how we are to approach him, how we're to worship him, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. The only reason that anybody doesn't follow that is because they feel self-sufficient. They start thinking that it's up to them instead of up to God. They become so familiar with God that they figure, God will be okay if I just bring him strange fire. That'll all work out okay. So the story of Samson has a very poignant morality to it. There is a moral to the story, and it's significant. It's not just don't cut your hair, which was a philosophy that I followed for many years. I was very committed to that philosophy. But it's really all about where is your reliance? What are you depending on? Are you depending on your own strength and your own ability? Do you think that your power to accomplish good emanates from you? Or are you wholly, completely reliant on God? And do you recognize him as the source of any good ability you have? That's the key to the story of Samson. So let's start in chapter 13, verse 1. Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. How many times have we seen that so far in the book of Judges? Just goes on and on and on, doesn't it? Just it keeps showing up, sure. God keeps delivering them. They become self-sufficient. They get comfortable. They have rest from their enemies. They have plenty to eat and drink. And then they ignore God. Very consistent human nature characteristic. I think I've said it enough times, I don't have to repeat it. But when we get comfortable, that's when we're in the most danger. Because we start getting self-sufficient, thinking we did it, thinking we're in control, self-made man, captain of my own destiny. And next thing you know, you're making terrible decisions because you think it's you that's in charge instead of doing things God's way. So the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so that the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. And there was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had borne no children. Then the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now, therefore, be careful not to drink wine or strong drink, and not eat any unclean thing. For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines." Then the woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of an angel of God, very awesome. And I did not ask him where he came from, nor did he tell me his name. But he said to me, 'Behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and now you shall not drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.'" Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, "O Lord, please let the man of God, whom thou hast sent, come to us again, that he may teach us what to do for the boy who is to be born." And God listened to the voice of Manoah. And the angel of God came again to the woman as she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So the woman ran quickly and told her husband, "Behold, the man who came the other day has appeared to me." Then Manoah arose and followed his wife, and when he came to the man, he said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to the woman?" And he said, "I am." And Manoah said, "Now, when your words come to pass, what shall be the boy's mode of life and his vocation?" So the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "Let the woman pay attention to everything that I said. She shall not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. Let her observe all that I have commanded." Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "Please let us detain you so that we may prepare a kid." And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "Though you detain me, I will not eat your food, but if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to the Lord." For Manoah did not know that he was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "What is your name, so that when your words come to pass, we may honor you?" But the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why do you ask my name, seeing that it is wonderful?" Let's stop there for a moment. It is that phrase that has caused many a commentator to say that this was a Christophany, because Isaiah will later identify Jesus as having the proper name, Wonderful, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Prince of Peace, the Mighty God, or the Mighty God, Prince of Peace. One of those two is the correct order. So there are some folk who say that the angel of the Lord here was a Christophany, but I'm not convinced that necessarily there's enough evidence to say without question it is. Notice also, though, that in looking at him, Manoah didn't realize, in looking at him face to face and speaking to him, Manoah didn't realize that this was an emissary of God, an angel of the Lord, that this was an eternal being. He looked so human-like, which I think is why the writer of Hebrews would say to remember to entertain strangers, and he said, "For in so doing, many have entertained angels unawares." In other words, part of the inspiration, according to the writer of Hebrews, for being good to strangers and taking care of sojourners and just being generally good to folks is that you never know when you may be in contact with a heavenly emissary. And certainly that's what was happening here. That's why throughout he's referred to as a man when they speak to him. We know the author tells us, as he's writing, it's an angel of the Lord. But when they speak, she goes to her husband and says, "A man said to me." And he says, "Well, go ask the man if he can come back." He says, "Are you the man that spoke to the woman?" So up until this moment of enlightenment, they weren't aware that they were speaking to an angel of the Lord. I also think it's interesting that Manoah asked for additional information. The angel of the Lord spoke and said, do this. Here's your directive. Don't eat anything unclean. Don't drink wine. Don't drink strong drink. Manoah said, let's see if we can talk to that guy again. I want more information. And he asks the angel of the Lord, so what's he going to be like, the boy? What's his vocation going to be? You know, what can we expect out of this guy? After all, I'm going to be his dad. I think behind it are questions like, you know, are we going to get rich? Are we going to have to run for cover? Are we going to, what's his job? What's his vocation going to be? And you'll notice the angel of the Lord is not in any way inspired to give him any additional information. Instead, he says, what did I already tell you? Just do what I said. Tell the woman to be careful what she eats and drinks, and that's as much as you need to know. In other words, we sometimes want to look into things that God simply isn't willing to tell us at this moment because he's already given us everything we need to know. I would argue, and often do argue, with folks who talk about personal revelation or dreams or interpretations of... I learned an interesting word this week. Can I share an interesting word with you? Sure, Jim. Okay, I will. I was reading through Stott's book of miscellany, and in one of the lists, miscellaneous lists, there was lists of various different ways that people interpret things like tea leaves or bumps on your head or those kind of interpretive things. And I didn't realize that all those different methodologies had names. But in the list, there was the random interpretation of selective Bible verses, and it was called bibliomancy. Isn't that a great word? Yeah.
I've only heard that with necromancy.
I know. Private interpretation from the dead. So if you're into private interpretation of secretive things you've dug out of random verses of the Bible, bibliomancy, what a great word. Well, so I have in my life occasionally had to deal with the occasional bibliomancer who is very into his private interpretation or always looking for something more or never content with what God has already said. They want a great deal more. You can hear the preachers all the time on the TV talking about how they need to go to a higher level and you need a greater infilling of the Spirit and you need a larger outpouring and you need a greater word of knowledge and you need more. Never content with what God has already said. And of course, I argue that if you have yet to master what God has already said. And since I don't believe that there is such a thing as mastery of the Bible, since no one has mastered what God has already said, we don't need to be chasing around for additional information because we still don't have a firm grasp on the information he's given us. So anyway, Manoah said, tell me more. And the angel of the Lord said, just do what I told you. So why do you ask for my name, says verse 18, seeing that it is wonderful. That may be a proper name. My name is wonderful. Or it may just be that my name is really too wonderful for humans to hear. It's a heavenly name. It's a name that God uses when speaking to me. And knowing that it is beyond this human plane, don't ask me to say a name that a sinner like you couldn't comprehend. My name is too wonderful for you. Which kind of fits the character of this angel of the Lord who has already said, I'm not going to tell you more, just do what I told you. And why are you asking for my name, seeing that it's too wonderful for you? Which means that the angel of the Lord, by the way, has a very low estimation of humans and a very high estimation of God and his word. Yes, sir?
The NIV does interpret it as beyond understanding.
My name is beyond understanding, yeah. Verse 19, so Manoah took the kid with the grain offering and offered it on the rock to the Lord, and he performed wonders while Manoah and his wife looked on. For it came about, when the flame went up from the altar toward heaven, that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. Well, that is quite wonderful. That is quite beyond understanding. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. Well, yeah, I'll bet. If you're talking to a guy who you think is just a guy, and then you light a fire to the Lord, and the fire engulfs the guy and he goes up into the sky in the flame, you're falling down. You're getting on your face and saying, we have just witnessed something beyond our everyday comprehension. Now the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah or his wife, which is interesting because that means that once he said, I'm on a mission, I've told you what to do. Tell me more. That's not what I'm here for. I'm leaving now. I've told you what I came to tell you. It's not my job to tell you more. If God doesn't speak, even the angels don't speak. And that's interesting. We could learn something from them. Because far too often humans are willing to speak where God has not spoken. Far too often, even in the Bible, there is talk of false prophets who say things God didn't say. And God goes so far as to say, woe to the prophets who say, thus says the Lord, when I have not said. So we have to be very careful to make sure that when we speak about God, or when we speak for God, that we are speaking God's words. Ideally, what Christianity is, by the way, and what ideally what good Bible education is a way of learning to speak God's words after Him. Whatever God has spoken, that's what we should be speaking. What God has said, that's what we're to say. But we're not to instigate our own imagination and blame God for it. Notice how carefully this angel came, said exactly what he was sent to say. When he was asked to say more, said, I've already told you what I came to say. And then he left and didn't have anything else to say.
He delivered the
message he was supposed to deliver. Couldn't we learn something there?
He's a servant like we are.
He's a servant like we are, and we all serve God. Say what God says. Keep yourself out of it. So the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of Yahweh. So Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die, for we have seen God. He goes immediately to the far opposite extreme. A minute ago, he was willing to put him to the test. It was, tell me more. Oh, well, what about if we make a kid for you? What about if we... Manoah thought he was in charge. The angel made sure that Manoah realized that he was not in charge. So Manoah goes to the far other extreme and goes, okay, now we're going to die because we've seen God. But it doesn't say that they saw God. They saw a messenger from God. They saw an angel of the Lord. His wife, who apparently was much smarter than him, not only corrects his theology, but corrects his logic. His wife said to him, if the Lord had desired to kill us, He would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would He have shown us all these things, nor would He have let us hear things like this at this time. In other words, if God meant to kill us, we'd be dead. But instead of being dead, He accepted our offering and told us that we're going to have a child. So clearly He's not planning to kill us. Logical woman. Then the woman gave birth to a son and named him Samson. And the child grew up, and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir in Mahanadan between Zorah and Eshtaol. Then Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. So he came back and told his father and mother, and said, I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife. Then his father and his mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people that you would go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she looks good to me. Which is pretty much all it took. I'm telling you. The Philistine woman is a dish. Get her, Dad. But notice Dad and Mom had the right idea and said, you're supposed to take a wife from among your own people. And are you really saying that there's not a single woman in all of Israel good enough for you that you have to go to the uncircumcised Philistines? Very important language. Israel were circumcised. That was the mark of their descendancy from Abraham. That was the mark of their unconditional covenant from God. And so all the other people groups were uncircumcised, showing that they were not the covenant people of God. So do you have to go outside the covenant to find a wife? And his whole defense is, yeah, but look at her. Yeah. Don't shake your head, Marilyn. Because there was a day when Conrad saw you and went, yeah, but look at her. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think,
there was no yeah, but. It was just look at her. Just look at her. You're right. I know. Aw. I know. Except that when Samson did it, she was sitting over there going, men. I could hear it. I could hear her thinking it. Men.
It's the way we are.
It's the way we are.
Okay, we're going to use that next time.
Yeah. We're moving on, people. So, he said, look at her. She looks good to me. However, his father and his mother did not know that it was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, that's a fascinating thing for the writer of Judges to include. Because at this moment, what Samson was wanting to do was against what God had instructed. And Samson was going to go take a woman from the Philistines, which means that God overrode Samson's free will and made him attracted to a Philistine woman on purpose because God was out to get the Philistines. And so everything that now happens between Samson and his wife, and it's not a pretty story, everything that happens is of God so that Samson will go after the Philistines. Had he simply stayed in Israel and married an Israelite woman, he may have never gotten mad enough at the Philistines to go to war with them. He may have been content. He may have gotten a pretty Israelite woman who cooked well, and he could have just sat home and been fat and sassy and satisfied and just never going to go after the Philistines. But God changed Samson's affections in such a way that he was drawn to a Philistine woman, and even though it was a sinful thing for Samson to do, God in his great compatibilism used the willful sinfulness of a man to accomplish his greater plan. How often have we seen this in the Bible? Over and over and over again, God uses the sinful desires of human beings to accomplish his greater good. That's a really, really sovereign God. His father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, for God was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. Then Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came as far as the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came roaring toward him, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that he tore the lion as one tears a kid or a baby goat, though he had nothing in his hands. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. So this is Samson's first introduction to the reality that he had this strength, this power that was not typical for human beings, but it only occurred when the Spirit of God was on him. And this was an exercise, I think, designed to build Samson's confidence up in order for Samson to realize that when God was with him, he was going to be mighty. He didn't start at conquering people with the jawbone of a donkey. He didn't start there. He started with fighting a lion with his bare hands.
Like David.
Much like David. So he went down and he talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. I think we've established that fact now. I think we're all comfortable with that idea. When he returned later to take her, he turned aside to look at the carcass of the lion, and behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the body of the lion. So he scraped the honey into his hands, and he went on eating it as he went. When he came to his father and his mother, he gave some to them, and they ate it, but he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey out of the carcass of a dead lion. Well, yeah, you don't want to mention that part. But apparently it was perfectly good honey, honeycomb. If he was carrying it in his hand, it was obviously some of the honeycomb that he was eating. So then his father, says verse 10, went down to the woman, and Samson made a feast there, for the young men customarily did this. And it came about, when they saw him, that they brought 30 companions to be with him. Then Samson said to them, let me now propound a riddle to you. If you will indeed tell it to me within the 7 days of the feast, If you can find it out, then I will give you 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. What does that tell you, by the way, about Samson and his family? Pretty wealthy. Pretty well to do. Got some stuff. If he can just give away 30 linens, 30 changes of clothes on something as silly as a riddle, then these are folks that have plenty. And he's making a 7-day feast for him and his companions to impress her. But if you're unable to tell me, then you shall give me 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. In their case, since there were 30 of them, the 30 companions, they each only had to give up one. If he lost, he had to give up 30. So they said to him, "Propound your riddle that we may hear it." So he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet." But they could not tell the riddle in 3 days. Then it came about on the fourth day that they said to Samson's wife, "Entice your husband that he may tell us the riddle, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire." Inspiration to find out what the riddle is all about. "Have you invited us here to impoverish us? Is this not so?" In other words, they're saying, now you're in cahoots with your husband. You're just trying on your wedding day to get a bunch of extra gifts out of us. You're trying to get extra changes of clothes out of us by this riddle that your husband has asked us. Husband here may be betrothed. The wedding may or may not have happened. This is the feast that's going on at this moment. Usually at the end of the feast, that's when there's the actual act that brings about the union of the husband and wife. But being betrothed, they're referred to already as husband and wife. Verse 16, Samson's wife wept before Samson and said, "You only hate me and you do not love me. This marriage is off to a good start."
Sounds normal to me.
Sounds normal to you. I'm just going to step back from that. Already, she's got friends and companions that are upset with her and saying, if you don't find out the riddle, we're going to burn down you and your father's house. She goes to the new husband and says, "You hate me and you do not love me." And I'm trying real hard not to put a heavy inflection on that. And it still came through, didn't it? "You have propounded a riddle to the sons of my people and have not told it to me." And he said to her, "Behold, I have not told it to my father or mother, so should I tell you?" In other words, I haven't told them the answer. I haven't divulged the answer to anybody. "However, she wept before him 7 days while their feast lasted." This was supposed to be the happy wedding feast. I finally got this wife who looked good to me, and it turns out that she's a drama queen. 7 days of the feast, she's weeping and crying, "Tell me." Right. Now, there is a fair inspiration there. "My companions are going to burn down my father's house. It would be good if you told me." I'm with you, Charlie. "And it came about on the seventh day that he told her because she pressed him so hard." Men, what does this tell us?
That you love your women and you don't want to see them crying.
Wasn't that amazing? One of the men threw their voice into Jennifer's mouth. Ventriloquism just occurred in the room.
Just helping out with the answer there.
Yes. "And it came about on the seventh day that he told her because she pressed him so hard. She then told the riddle to the sons of her people. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, 'What is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion?'" In other words, they were acting like they figured it out. "And he said to them, 'If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle.'" I'm just going to let that sit there. I don't have a great deal to say about that. Obviously, it's a euphemism. He's just saying, if you hadn't come over here and made use of something that belonged to me, that was my wife, and you pressed my wife in order to get the answer and have it come to you, you used what was mine in order to get the answer. You didn't figure it out yourself. That's what the phrase, "had you not plowed with my heifer," means. So verse 19, "Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily," just like when he tore the lion. "And he went down to Ashkelon And he killed 30 of them and took their spoils and gave the changes of clothes to those who told the riddle. And his anger burned, and he went up to his father's house. But Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his friend. So this all went bad really fast. He went down there for the feast. He had a betrothed wife. And in the end, he ends up going into Ashkelon and killing 30 people and took their stuff so that he was really taking Philistine goods and giving them to the other Philistines who had cheated by going through his wife in order to get the answer. And then he took off and left her there, apparently, so she was then given to a different guy. End of Samson's marriage, by the way. But after a while, says chapter 15, but after a while, in the time of wheat harvest, it came about that Samson visited his wife with a young goat and said, I will go into my wife in her room, but her father did not let him enter. And her father said, I really thought that you hated her intensely, so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please let her be yours instead. Samson then said to them, this time I shall be blameless in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm. And Samson went and caught 300 foxes. By the way, not a small task. Then took torches and turned the foxes tail to tail. In other words, he took two foxes, would tie their tails together, and put one torch in the middle between the two tails, would light the torches, and since their tails were tied, they would run. They would try to get undone. So this was his way of guaranteeing that they would keep scampering and running and scampering. And when he set fire to the torches, he released the foxes into the standing grain of the Philistines, thus burning up both the shocks and the standing grain, along with the vineyards and the groves. Destroyed their food supply and their vineyards, their grapes for their wine, destroyed it by sending out 150 teams of burning foxes. Pretty clever. And the Philistines said, who did this? And they said, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he took his wife and gave her to his companion. So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. And Samson said to them, since you act like this, I will surely take revenge on you, but after that, I will quit. And he struck them ruthlessly with a great slaughter, and he went down and lived in the cleft of the rock of Etam. Now, you have to figure, after all this, he's seen a beautiful woman, he's now going to be betrothed to her, in the midst of the disagreement with the 30 friends, them going through his wife in order to find out the answer to the riddle and then holding him to it, so he goes and gets some Philistine goods to give to these lying Philistines who had been his companions, acted as if they were friends. So then he, in his anger, leaves. He comes back with a goat, a gift for his wife, with the intention of now betrothing her, sleeping with her, actually consummating the marriage. And dad meets him at the door and says, no, I've already given her to somebody else. She's already slept with another man. He, of course, in his anger, goes out there and does something really rash, but also very judgmental. Remember, this is all God doing this on purpose, God working behind the scenes, because he was trying to punish the Philistines, and he was going to do it through Samson. So he's using Samson's anger and his rashness to burn down the fields, which then caused the people to retaliate, which then causes Samson to retaliate, and he went from, hey, I'm getting married, to hey, I'm killing and burning, and then ends up just sitting in a cave in the cleft of a rock. Yeah.
The angel would have had a hard time describing that to Manoah.
Yeah, when Manoah said, so what's his occupation going to be? Well, he's going to be tying foxes together, burning down fields, killing people.
And then, be a fox catcher.
Exactly. And then he's going to hide in a cave somewhere. Would have been tough to explain, you're right. But what I want you to see is, notice where he went. He didn't go back to mom and dad's house. He didn't go anywhere. He needed to hide after having killed all these people and having burned all this stuff. He needed to hide for a while. It's a very depressing picture. And as much as we've made light of the story of him and his friends and his wedding and plowing with his heifer and all that, at this moment, it's actually a very depressing picture. Having killed all these people, having gone in the spirit of the Lord and done all this destruction, you now find him hiding in the cleft of a rock. It's not a jolly picture. Verse 9. Then the Philistines went up and camped in Judah and spread out in Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" And they said, "We have come up to bind Samson in order to do to him as he did to us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock at Edom and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I have done to them." And they said to him, "We have come down to bind you, so that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines." And Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me." So they said to him, "No, but we will bind you fast and give you into their hands, yet surely we will not kill you." Then they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. When they came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted as they met him, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that the ropes that were on his arms were like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds dropped from his hands. And he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. So he reached out and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have killed 1,000 men." Not only has he killed 1,000 people with nothing but a bone, a jawbone, which is sharp, and he used that and killed 1,000 people in the Spirit of God, and then he mocks them and announces his victory. Now, there's some degree to which the announcement of the victory is an indication of the personality of Samson. He says, "I did this with the jawbone of a donkey. I have killed 1,000 men." And this is his problem all the way along, is that he continues to think that it's his power that is doing these things. It's his strength, his might, as opposed to recognizing that this is the Spirit of God working out his own sovereign will through Samson. And it came about when he had finished speaking that he threw the jawbone from his hand, and he named the place Ramoth-Lehi. Then he became very thirsty, and he called to the Lord and said, "Thou hast given this great deliverance by the hand of thy servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" Notice that even when he does call out to God, now he needs something. This, again, I kept saying, this is a microcosm of Israel's problem. When they're doing well, they say, "Me, I did. This is us. We're fine. Chase our foreign gods or foreign women or don't do things God's way." But then when they have problems, they start giving God credit. So now he's thirsty. He's out there in the desert. Now he goes to God. And not only does he call out to God and give God credit for the great victory, but then he includes, "And now am I going to die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" Like, gosh, God, don't you know what's happening down here? Don't you realize I'm the great hero, and now here I am, I'm thirsty, and you're going to let me die out here? Who does this remind you of, by the way? Does this sound anything like the Israelites wandering in the wilderness? Yeah. "You brought us out here to kill us." When they had no water, "You brought us out here to kill us with thirst." Even when he gave them bread from heaven, "Our soul loathes this light bread."
It sounds like everybody.
It sounds like everybody, doesn't it? It sounds like everybody who ever walked this earth, where we say, "It's good, we're good, we're good, it's me, I'm good." And then you give God maybe a little credit. God worked through me, but it's me. It's really about me. It's me. It's my ministry. I'm just going to put the name of my name right in the ministry. It's just the me ministry. It's all about me. I might even start a school and put my name on it. It'll just be the me school and the me church and the me ministry because it's all about me. And then things go hard and it's, well, boy, I sure need God. God, don't you care that I'm suffering down here? Don't you care that things are going hard down here for me, God? Jennifer's completely right. Boy, that's every human who ever walked the planet. Starting at Adam and moving from there. Verse 19. But God split the hollow place that is in Lehi so that water came out of it. What does that remind you of? Water from a rock. When the children of Israel reached the point where they said, we're completely out of water. We're out here in the wilderness. We have nothing. And so God said, I'll give you water from a rock. Same God, still dealing with people the same way. And split open the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out. And when he drank, his strength returned and he revived. Therefore, he named it En-Hakkor, which is in Lehi to this very day. So he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. What does En-Hakkor mean, Gladys?
Spring of the caller.
The one who's calling.
Call out to God.
Exactly. Let's do a little bit of chapter 16. Can I have a few more minutes? Because we started a little late. Sorry, what was that? Oh, okay. We started a little late, but I'm blaming Marilyn. Yes?
Just a quick question. I'm reading from the King James, and it says, but God clave a hollow place that was in the jaw, and there came water there out, and when he had drunk, his spirit came again, and he revived.
It sounds a little bit like that in this scripture, too.
What does it say?
Well, it says, God split the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out. But in the, where it says literally, jawbone.
It would be hard to say that it was the jawbone, considering that it says earlier that he threw the jawbone down and then went to Lehi. If it's the same jawbone, then we're saying that somehow that jawbone followed him, which is why the NASB, some of the newer translations, try to clear that up and say that it was a hollow place that is in Lehi. It would be hard to imagine that he split the jawbone and the water came out. Where the jawbone incident took place. Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay.
Chapter 16, verse 1. Now Samson went to Gaza and saw a harlot there, and he went in to her. And when it was told to the Gazites, saying, Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. And they kept silent all night, saying, let us wait until morning light, and then we will kill him. Now Samson lay until midnight, and at midnight he arose, and he took hold of the doors of the city gate and the two posts and pulled them up along with the bars. And then he put them on his shoulders, and he carried them to the top of the mountain, which is opposite Hebron. After this, it came about that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, entice him and see where this great strength lies and how we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him. And then we will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So that's a lot of money. And remember earlier he was bound with ropes, new ropes it even says. And yet, when the Spirit of the Lord came on him, he broke them. So they couldn't figure out how to bind him. When they thought they had him in a city and they closed the city doors, thinking they could keep him in, he pulled the doors, the posts, everything up, and didn't just leave them there, he dragged them to the top of a hill. And so they're in awe of this man's strength and power. And so now they want to know, what's it going to take to bind him? And gee, Delilah, he seems to like you. So maybe you could find out, where is this power coming from? Now, what they haven't figured out is that the power is coming from the Spirit of God. They're in the flesh. They're thinking fleshly. They're thinking this is some strength that he individually has. Or maybe he eats some kind of food. Or maybe he has some magic elixir. Or maybe he has some way that he is creating this power. We'd like to know where it comes from and how we can get it. And what do we got to do to stop this guy? And they're going to use Delilah to find out. So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, "Entice him and see where his great strength lies and how we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him, and then we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver." So Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me where your great strength is and how you may be bound to afflict you." It amazes me that he entertains that question. Because, red flag, absolutely. Well, he wisely gives her a story. And Samson said to her, "If they bind me with 7 fresh cords that have never been dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." The objective there is, if the cords are made of leather and the leather is wet and he's tied with the wet leather, as the leather dries, it shrinks. And so that would be a way of binding him. 7 new cords that haven't yet been dried out. They would shrink around me. I'd be caught. There's nothing I could do about it. Then the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh cords that had not been dried, and she bound him with them. And apparently he stood there and took it. Now she had men lying in wait in the inner room, and she said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he snapped the cords like a string of toe snaps when they touched the fire, so his strength was still not discovered. Then Delilah said to Samson, "Behold, you have deceived me, and you have told me lies. Now please tell me how you may be bound." And he said to her, "If they bind me tightly with new ropes, which have never been used, then I shall become weak like any other man." So Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them, and said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." For the men were lying in wait in the inner room, but he snapped the ropes from his arms like a thread. Then Delilah said to Samson, "Up to now you have deceived me and told me lies." And then she stomped her foot. I read that in there. I just read it in there. Just seemed like a consistent personality profile. "Tell me how you may be bound." And he said to her, "If you weave the 7 locks of my hair with the web or into a loom, fasten it with a pin, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." So while he slept, Delilah took the 7 locks of his hair and wove them into the web or into a loom. And she fastened it with a pin and said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he awoke from his sleep, and he pulled the pin out of the loom and out of the web. Starting at verse 15, he's actually going to divulge what he believes to be the secret to his strength, and it's going to be the beginning of the downfall of Samson, and that's where we'll pick up next week. Right there at verse 15 of chapter 16, we start there. Okay? Any questions about that?
Well, I'm sorry that I don't remember. This just gave the Israelites a little more peace?
Only slightly. In fact, I'm of a mind to think, Gladys, that had he remained faithful, that God had in mind to use him for even greater exploits. But his pride, his ego, his rebellion gets the better of him. And then that's it for the book of Judges. There are no more major judges recorded in this book. And instead, what you're going to see is internal strife and fighting and the destruction of the tribe of Benjamin. And that's the way the book ends. It ends with Israel in a sorry state. And then just because of the order of the books of the Old Testament, we get the book of Ruth. And that's really interesting. And we're going to go through it. And we're going to learn the kinsman redeemer concept. It's clearly Christological. And it speaks forward of Christ and has all this great typology in it. But then you get into 1 and 2 Samuel. And like I said in the introductory notes, Samuel really does more good for Israel in terms of helping them to have some freedom and conquer their enemies. And he doesn't do it through might and strength and fighting like the judges in the book of Judges do. He does it through prayer and reliance on God. So yeah, I think there's a huge lesson to be learned there too. The book of Judges stands as a testimony to the weakness of human determination, to the weakness of humans to stay consistent in their faithfulness to God. As soon as they get comfortable, they run away from God. Even though he delivers them and sends them heroes to deliver them, it's not enough to convict them for any period of time at all. It's not until a prophet, a man of God comes who's going to be the one who anoints the man after God's own heart. And so you see the beginning of God restoring Israel from their rebellion and from their fighting and from their warfare, which has gone on ever since they entered the promised land. They're finally going to become established as a nation under godly headship when God finally puts David on a throne over them. But even then, they got to go through Saul to get there. And so the big picture story there is, until God brings a peaceful leader, judge, king, there's no peace in Israel. Men, by their own strength and their own machinations, can never bring about genuine peace or genuine relationship with God. And that all typifies Christ. When Christ comes, the Prince of Peace, there will finally be peace on earth. And between now and when he comes, the world is full of men who will go through their machinations and their wars and their attempts to settle accounts between themselves and figure out who gets what land and how much and who gets what money and how much and who gets what food and how much. But they're never going to be settled, and they're always going to fight, and they're always going to war. And they're going to say peace, peace, but there's not going to be any peace until God establishes his king on David's throne and plants him on the earth. Then there's going to be 1,000 years of peace on the planet. And all of that is being foreshadowed in the way that the book of Judges is laid out and Samuel and David coming on the scene in 1 and 2 Samuel. So there's a real big picture being developed here. And we're missing something if we've missed that. Got it? It's a great story, but it has a morality to it that I want us to make sure we get.
What I'm saying is that whole thing is such a story and the moral and the spiritual values and the teachings,
yes,
all woven together.
And look again at the sovereignty of God, who is moving people and nations and kingdoms around in order to tell his story. He's telling his story through the history of human beings. So that by the time his son comes to the earth, the story his son is telling is the same story that God has been telling in history. And his son's going to come and say it in words, and Paul's going to put it into doctrine, and then the church is supposed to go out and announce that. But the story doesn't change. The story is God is sovereign, men are incapable, and there's no peace until you have peace with God through Jesus Christ. And that story is consistent all the way through. Men need a mediator between them and that God. And God decides who the mediators are. And he decides who the judges are. And he decides who the priest is. And he decides who, you know, he decided who the high priest was going to be. It's going to be Aaron. He decided who the king is going to be. It's not going to be Saul, the one that the people like because he was a head taller than everybody else. It's going to be David because he's a man after God's own heart. It's always God who chooses the prophets. It's going to be Samuel. It's going to be, he's going to be David's prophet. God picks prophets, priests, kings. Absolutely. And so it's no mistake that throughout the Bible, no man ever accomplishes the offices of prophet, priest, and king to themselves till Christ comes on the planet, and then he is spoken of as God's prophet, his priest, and his king, because he is the fulfillment of all those shadows and types that are spelled out through the history of Israel in the Old Testament. They all continue to lead to and preach the message of, look to him, he's the mediator you really need, he's the king you really need, he's the prophet you really need. The book of Hebrews, when we get to it on Sunday mornings, opens with that idea that God in various times and in sundry places spoke to us through the prophets, but he has in these last days spoken to us through his son. That theme runs through the New Testament.
Who is heir of all things.
Who is the heir of all things. Exactly right. So I like these stories in the book of Judges, but I don't want us to miss the big picture. And the big picture is that really the book of Judges is setting you up for 1 and 2 Samuel, which is setting you up for David and the Davidic covenant, which has in it the promise of Christ sitting on that throne. And that's where real peace is. You got all that?
Yes.
Okay, that was the big picture stuff.
But look, this this lesson tonight explained why Naomi and her husband were poor.
Yeah.
And had gone somewhere else seeking food.
Absolutely. And by the way, doesn't God bring about famines? Isn't that what he does? You know, he's in charge of all this stuff. And that's why I said he moves people groups. He brought a famine on all of Israel and Egypt. And lots of people suffered just so that he could get Joseph's 11 brothers to come face him. I mean, God is willing to move nations and people groups and kings and do whatever he's got to do in order to prove his sovereignty and his story. I'm sorry, what'd you say? He does all that to establish his kingdom. Yeah, exactly right. That's the same sovereign God we've been talking about on Sunday mornings. Same God at work doing the same thing, which is sitting on his throne doing whatever pleases him. And fortunately, he took the time to tell us about it so that we can look at it and go, oh, you're that kind of God. Right?
Right.
All right.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.